Good. I'd like to ask for your attention. The tradition of early Buddhism reports these Brahmaviharas as on different levels. The level that is most famous or has become most in the forefront of the tradition's commentary is the level of the Brahmaviharas as objects of meditation. In other words, Brahmaviharas are basically meditators' homework. This is something you do in your formal meditation practice. You cultivate states of Brahmavihara to infuse your mind and to suffuse your world with that quality and to make it as deep and as lasting and as unlimited as possible. So that would be the Brahmavihara as a meditational exercise. The commentaries are full of that. If you do this sort of practice, you are likely to have encountered such teachings. It starts generally with a wish, and then it generates a wish not just for oneself, but for others, and then specific others, others you like, others you don't like, others you feel neutral towards. It's a very powerful exercise. We'll do one more tomorrow. And it is a meditative exercise. This is a crucial ingredient of Brahmavihara practice, but it is only one aspect. Now, the Brahmaviharas, and that's my point, is Brahmaviharas are not just meditative exercises. Brahmaviharas are first and foremost inalienable qualities of the human heart. The Buddhist teaching is predicated on the notion that human beings are fundamentally capable of loving, of being compassionate, of experiencing joy, and of staying in a relational way connected while being equanimous. It's important. Equanimity is a relational quality. It's not the bit that happens when I've got rid of everything that might bother me, or when nothing means anything anymore to me. Equanimity is probably one of the most misunderstood qualities. It is important to remember that what is easy to understand in metta and loving kindness, that it is relational. What is reasonably easy with karuna or karuna, technically, that it is relational. It's the pain of somebody else that touches me and that gives rise to the wish to alleviate that pain. And what is still reasonably easy with mudita, the capacity to sympathetically resonate with success and good things in other people's lives in a joyous way. All this is not so straightforward when it comes to equanimity. Where is the relationship bit with equanimity? But even equanimity has a relational quality. It's me being in relation that I am capable of remaining equanimous in a state of serene relationship that honors ownership and responsibility of both me and the other. So, these four Brahmaviharas are first and foremost capacities of the human heart. Every heart is capable. Not every heart has developed these things, but no heart is without these fundamental capacities. And that's why I don't settle for Brahmaviharas as emotions, because as soon as we have them as emotions, we have them as states, and states change. And if the state is not there, because it is changing, it's basically gone. So a Brahmavihara is it's a kind of archetypal patterning of mind. It's a paradigm, a degree of availability. It can be cultivated or occluded. It can be highly developed or it can be rudimentary there. But we cannot lose it. That's the kick about it. The fundamental capacity to relate to others in loving, caring and compassionate, joyous and equanimous ways, we cannot lose. It's not a virtue. We don't earn it. We don't have to do it in our meditative homework. We don't have to pay for it. It cannot be taken away and it cannot be lost. That's what constitutes our humanness. That's the Buddhist take on Brahma-viharas. That's rock bottom. Yeah? It doesn't mean that human beings can't be cruel or stupid or greedy, but they do not lose their capacity for kindness or care or loving relationship or joy or equanimity when they are behaving in opposite ways. More about opposite ways tomorrow. On a second level, this is where it gets interesting. These Brahma-viharas are virtues. Now, the interesting things about virtues is they can be strengthened, they can be developed, they can be recognized, they can be admired, they can be fortified in oneself. That's the kick of a virtue, that you can practice it. It's different from the first level. On that second level, they resemble most closely to emotions. They resemble most closely to states. We're obviously encouraged to stay as long as we can in those states. Particularly with other human beings, we're encouraged to have access to these four frames of mind, four qualities of mind as the basic paradigm of our relationships. On that second level, these Brahma-viharas can be affirmed. I can affirm kindness, I can affirm compassion, I can affirm joy, I can affirm equanimity. In fact, all cultures do, across the board. Nobody I know, no culture I know, really, truly appreciates impatient hotheads. Not Tibetans, not Thai, not Swiss. I'm sure English don't. I'm sure it's pretty looked down upon here. Yeah? Impatient hotheads are not going down well in this culture, as far as I've made out. Yeah? Maybe we put up with them, maybe we fear them, but we don't really trust them. We don't really give them high office. We don't really give them our affection. Maybe we grovel. Maybe we avoid, maybe we're contemptuous about them, but we don't really give them our trust. People who are impatient and hot-headed and angry, we don't generally reward with our confidence or our trust or our affection. In fact, this is the most isolating kind of experience I know, getting angry. Getting publicly angry is even worse. Privately angry is bad enough, but publicly angry, this is a very isolating experience. So, on the second level, Brahma-viharas are the social oil. They are the grease of our relationships. They are the grease of our fabric of society. Even high politicians, highly paid politicians, play niceties to each other because they've realized, however power they have and however good the information of their secret service is, basically trust doesn't develop by knowing a lot about what the other guy is doing, but basic trust develops in relationship. Yeah. This is famous snippet of dialogue in one of the, it was the SALT II talks with, I think it was with Reagan and his Russian counterpart. I think he may have been Gorbachev. And at one point Reagan says, but you can't seriously expect me to go home and tell the American people that I do this on trust. it precisely captured the crux of this. There's only one way this can work, and this is on the basis of trust. And It was obvious to the man that this needed happening, but it was unthinkable to the man that he could actually dare stand there, you know, in the Oval Office and in his speech to the nation say, look, he's a good guy, I trust him, let's do that. Yeah. So we all know that. Even politicians know that. And politicians don't seem to be the most knowledgeable folk around human nature, yeah, if we're looking at their actions. But even politicians know that trust develops in relationship. It doesn't develop when I have lots of information. And that's why these four Brahmaviharas are helping us connect. They create value. They create not just bonding and chummy, clubby feelings. They create trust. They create resonance. So this is an important part for me, because I am of the opinion that the early Buddhist tradition, as far as it has been taught by Theravada Buddhists, who tend to think they are the only early Buddhist people around, or the only legitimate Buddhist, early Buddhist people around, a claim that will have to be refuted on some other occasion, this tradition has not done most justice to one of its precious teachings. It has relegated the two other layers of these Brahmaviharas, sidelined them, and basically turned these Brahmaviharas to be the prerogative of meditating contemplatives, which is taking them out of normal life. It is making them a specialist pursuit. It is putting them into the service of better samatha practice, or of, you know, of minimizing anger in your own mind. You know? So I think it's necessary to acknowledge these Brahmaviharas in their other two layers, in the layer as the core of our humanity, and the Brahmaviharas as virtue to be practiced on an everyday level outside of formal meditation practice situations, that it is the most profound experience human beings can share with each other is engaging in a context of love, in a context of compassion, in a context of joy, and in a context of empathetic and equanimous relationship that honors responsibility. I'd like to just mention and say this, and hope you make note of these, that these Brahmaviharas are not just a few phrases you say. May I be well, may others be well, may all feathered beings be well, may all tupeds and bipeds, sorry, and quadrupeds and all legless ones be well. Yeah, Buddhists do that. You know, there's canonical evidence that metta teachings are given to protect particularly monks against dangers, snakes and centipedes. Buddhist monks recite that. Sarabhu, Musika. But this is not all of it. The power, the depth of that teaching is that this is where we are most human, when we acknowledge this capacity of mind, a capacity that nothing can take away, not trauma, not bad parenting, not fiscal duress of our governments. Nothing can take that away. Nothing can take that power of love, of joy, of resonating with others when they're in pain, and of staying in relationship when we are neither joyous or neither loving or neither compassionate. We can still stay in a kind and warm relationship. The metta quality doesn't quite go away, even with equanimity. These teachings are obviously particularly pertinent also in the formation of one's own mind. So, contrary to popular belief, the Buddha never said anger goes away with mindfulness. Just be mindful of it and that will undo your anger. That's with much of the mindfulness world sometimes seems to say. I've heard that countless times. Just be neutrally mindful and attend carefully to the arising of hatred, and then hatred will cease, because all things arise and cease. Yeah? So if you, as long as you don't do anything, it will cease. That is true to some extent. You are free at the moment when you don't engage with hatred, when you don't follow a hateful impulse or a hateful an activity that is fueled by a hateful impulse. It is true that you are to some degree freed from that. But hatred will continue arising if you just stay mindful of it. There's no guarantee that you will ever be free from hatred simply by, or aversion for that matter, simply by not acting on it and by being mindful of it. My own experience is it doesn't work. It's better to be mindful of it and not act on it, but it doesn't actually remove the root of the aversive or the angry impulse. Some things you can be mindful of until you're blue in your face. Yeah? And while you're free for the moment of your mindfulness, you're not free from the impulse and the re-arising of that impulse. You need to go deeper. And one way to go deeper is by applying forms of these Brahmaviharas. In terms of anger, the one that is most effective for me is karuna. It's quite clearly the capacity of the heart to resonate with someone else's pain. Let's make a distinction there, and I'll fill in some of the details tomorrow. The scriptures, the commentarial scriptures, tell us that the antidote to anger is loving kindness. And that is true, insofar as loving kindness, when practiced and deeply practiced, it's kind of like an inoculation. The mind is has a grounding in loving kindness, and such a mind that is instilled with loving kindness is a lot worse seedbed for hateful impulses. So hateful impulses do find a lot less ground in a mind that is practiced in loving kindness. So we need to distinguish. So it's a prophylactic. Metta is an excellent prophylactic when it comes to hatred. It's not such a good an intervention when it actually occurs. If you are actually angry, and if you're having hateful impulses, and if you feel aversion, covering that over with thoughts of loving kindness doesn't seem to work very well. It's kind of like sugar-coated cow pad, maybe, you know. So if the mind already has lapsed into a state of unlove, of aversion or ill will or anger or just sheer hate, yeah, just not wanting this rejecting or contempt or something like that, if the mind has already fallen into this, metta doesn't seem to be a very effective tool. Yeah. It's important to connect with the object of your aversion in ways and rehumanize that object. Turn it from being an object into a human being with whom you share a lot of your humanity. And for that, the most effective way to do is for me to connect with that being's wish for happiness, that being's fear of pain, that being's experience of failure, that being's experience of loss and disappointment, that being's proneness to alienation and loneliness. As soon as I can connect with that being's pain, somehow I affirm our shared humanity in ways that make it for me very difficult to continue loathing it or glowering at it or basically denying its humanity. Yeah. If I can affirm that this being, like me, experiences failures and has felt bereft and despondent and beaten back, this being has been left behind or has been abandoned, or it just felt pain, has felt helpless. I don't know how about you, but I really hate helplessness. This is really my bête noire. I really don't like to be helpless. Much of what I've done in my life, I have done to avoid being helpless. Where I was nice, I've tried to avoid being helpless. And where I was nasty, I've developed this to be getting out of a situation of helplessness. You may have similar things. We all have a few pet horror scenarios. Mine involves helplessness. So when I invoke that whoever has called my ire, has brought upon himself or herself my ire, then I try to recall that this person is as lost in the experience of helplessness as I am. And somehow, suddenly we are connected in ways that weren't the case before. Before, she was arrogant, she was domineering, she was conceited, she was stuck up, and she was maybe powerful or off the wall. Yeah. And afterwards, basically, I see this being as somebody who is in a similar predicament. And by affirming her vulnerability, in acknowledging my vulnerability, we are landing on the same page. And it becomes a lot more difficult to make this being the other, the enemy, I can no longer completely deprive her of what I would like to deprive her of. Say, you don't belong into my life. You don't have access to what is precious. You don't deserve being taken for real. Yeah? I can no longer do that in the same way when I have affirmed that this being is basically in the same boat. She's as lost when she's lost as I am lost when I'm lost. She fears. She goes to bed and her day is not finished. She has had successes and failures, and she, even in success, she fears the next failure. Yeah, because she knows you can't keep up your game. Yeah. And I know that deep down. And if I connect with that other being on that level, there's something we share. And the more I dwell on this, the more we share. Yeah. And my hatred abates. My anger abates. I may still not be pleased with her behavior or with her thinking or with her ideology or with her particular take on this one, but somehow this is not the only defining feature of her life, because she's also now somebody who is basically alone and afraid, and she's getting older, and she is, she has had so much pain in her life, like I have. And I can no longer completely deny this, that I share actually a whole load with this person. And that she doesn't deserve my hatred, that she doesn't that it doesn't help, and that if push comes to shove, I share more with her than I like to pretend we're not sharing. Yeah. We share a lot more than makes us different. Yeah. Even with your worst enemy, you share a lot more than probably you'd like to distinguish yourself from him or from her. And that is the most powerful way to counteract an already arisen aversive mind, in my experience. Find out whether this is the case for you. Obviously, you need to find a way in somehow. You need to find a way into that part of you which stomps the feet and which makes pronounced statements. You know, this is how it is. This is how it has always been. She has never been any different, and she will never change. There is a kind of volubility to such statements in one's own mind, if your mind resembles mine in any way, and something that says, I'm not talking with you. I'm not. This is just how it is. And the refusal to acknowledge any other facet of that aspect of reality is basically the affirmation of the hate. It is the affirmation of rejection, denial, contempt, and the pushing away. It's the dosha side of the mind. And as soon as I affirm the opposite, connection, vulnerability, pain, I'm strangely getting closer. I'm more intimate. I am less perfect. I am less entitled to be in my revengeful, wrathful sort of mode. If you start dwelling on the pain of the other and you start having fun at that, something went wrong with your karuna practice, yeah, you've slipped a little bit into sadism there. Yeah? So if your enjoyment at the idea of other people experiencing pain seems to go off the rails a bit, then this is probably not the sort of practice I meant. Yeah? Let me stop and let's sit for another 20 minutes.